Patients, consumers, they don't give a crap where the solution came from. No one cares whether this is a Sutter solution or a PAMP solution or a Kaiser solution or a Johns Hopkins solution. It is a totally made-up argument.
While other kids were out playing ball, Jeff Clapp was at home coding computer games to sell to his friends at school. After getting laid off from his dream job at Apple, he found his way to using the technology he loved to help people get better.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Hi, I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chewitz, enjoying our cool new music.
I think we finally found our music groove since our first show.
Absolutely. Well, this is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
And we're delighted to be here with Jeff Clapp, who's the CEO of a company called Better.
Good morning. Good to see you guys. Wait, am I smooth jazz? Is that what you're telling me? This is not cool. I'm not cool with this at all. Oh, dear.
So maybe we'll start off with the beginning. So back in the day when, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you first got involved in technology.
So I grew up in Massachusetts.
Go Sox!
Yeah, exactly. If this was a video, people could see David's got his Red Sox hat, Red Sox shirt on, and I would have almost wore my gear as well. But
I'm glad to see you wearing the obligatory vest.
Yeah, I've got my Silicon Valley North Face vest on, which means I'm here to raise money as well when we're done. So
we're going to make you do your Carlton Fisk when you're done.
Yes, so. Absolutely. I will wave it around the foul pole. So I grew up in Massachusetts. Family out in the middle of Massachusetts. So once you cross the Mississippi as you head towards California, you just tell everybody you grew up in Boston. But I actually grew up a little bit more towards Central Mass. Farming community, apple community, probably the last place you would see. And by apple, I mean the stuff that grows on trees, not the computer maker we all know now. And I got very lucky to get turned on to technology by my stepfather. My parents divorced when I was pretty young, and new guy came into my life who was a VP of engineering at a company in Marlborough, Massachusetts. And he would just expose us to stuff. There was an Apple II in the house, and I just took to it. And within probably a year of that being in the house, I had a TI-99/4A before that with a cassette tape that I would save my programs to. And then they saw that I was into that, and then they put an Apple II in the house, and then I was staying home sick from school to program games that I would then take in the next day on a floppy disk and sell to kids. I would make games for the Apple II and sell them and send in.
Sounds very authentic.
Insider Magazine. Yeah, I mean, it was like back.
So you were making money, but not getting a lot of dates. Is that what you're saying?
So I think that's pretty much my life. Absolutely. it was actually really funny. Like that was grade school. Like grade school was there was a kid named Mike Blanding. I hope he hears me say his name. He lived up the street, and he got into it too. And we would cut the slots out of 5 1/4 inch floppy disks to make them double sided and record games on them and then sell them at a huge profit and then buy more computer stuff. Like I said, I stayed home from school sick and all that stuff. My goal was always one thing, which was to move to Cupertino and work for Apple. Like that became my goal. Like other kids wanted to be firemen. There wasn't a career for me in professional soccer. So I was like, all right, well,
I thought it was hockey. For Apple.
So I started playing hockey. I grew up playing hockey, but soccer was my thing. We were state champs and soccer was my thing. I played on the state team and stuff. And
what position?
I was a fullback. So I was a marking back. So, which just means I'm not graceful to actually score any goals.
But you look intimidated.
But I could definitely get in the way of other people trying to do that. So,
it's a handy skill for entrepreneurs as well.
Huh? I'm amazingly good at getting in the way, not getting dates and, making money by selling things. So there you go. There's my career. Are we done? So,
well, it's been great, Jeff.
Yeah.
So you got your wish, right? You went to Apple and worked in Cupertino.
Yeah, I was so lucky. So
how did that happen?
My school, Goucher College, requires an internship, and I was there to play soccer. At that point, especially as you get a little older, I went there to play soccer. I thought I was done with computers because honestly, the education system wasn't caught up. Like the stuff I was writing and doing, not to be, bragging about it, but like school hadn't caught up. Like the classes were boring. Like I hated them. And I was kind of done. I thought I was going to do politics, and I was there to play soccer. And they're like, well, you have to do an internship. That's part of graduating. So when I got there, I'm like, well, screw this. I can get an internship doing computer stuff, get that out of the way so I can spend more time playing soccer and, trying to figure out how to break into government. Did the internship. Realized, oh, my God, I don't know anything about computers, about being a true professional. I interned at a place called RWD Technologies. It turned into a full-time job, so I would go there and work at night. It was funny because, I was 17, 18, whatever, and I had to wear a tie to work. So I would wear, like, fish ties because I was just sitting in front of the computer programming. Nobody gave a crap what I was doing, right? I was just like, get it done. You know, they would take me to these meetings, and I had to learn really at a really young age, like how to behave in a, you know, a consulting thing. I worked on Glaxo Pharmaceuticals Salesforce automation tool and Caterpillar's automation tool for their big equipment. And I was writing C++ code for Apple and Apple Computer. And then the local sales rep came along and kind of noticed me and figured out I was still in school and said, I won't call out this company for charging you out at senior engineer rates when you don't have a degree if you get, you know, if you'll interview at Apple. And I was like, well, this is an easy choice. So I interviewed at Apple. They made me an offer. I literally the day after graduation, I packed everything in the car and drove cross country. So
did you graduate?
I did. I do have a degree. eventually that happened. I actually have degrees in cognitive psychology and computer science. So,
wow.
But yeah, so it was like packed up the car, drove cross country with my brother, and came to California. I was if it wasn't for the fact that when Steve Jobs came back, he laid off half the company, and I was in this advanced technology division doing developer tools that he cut. Our whole building got laid off. And if it wasn't, I'd still be there. I'd probably be 400 pounds sitting in an office with a really long beard just coding and probably loving it.
I can't figure out if the right visual for this is sort of the Code Monkey video or if the guy's from South Park.
I was thinking ZZ Top myself by the description.
I think if you put all three of those into a, you know, the Apple cafeteria, that would have been me. Like I the Apple cafeteria for me was like this amazing thing. My office looked out on the area in the middle of Infinite Loop. Like I was, you know, early 20s, just.
So what year was it you started there?
95.
And so what were you working on? What was the first thing you worked on at Apple?
The first thing I worked on was a C++ framework. There was four people that worked on it. I got the like junior position that only came up every couple of years. I didn't realize how prestigious it was until many years later. Called MacApp. And MacApp was a C++ framework that was used to create things like Photoshop and all this stuff. We were creating the tools that other people use. And man, it was just the best. Like, I have nothing but such great memories of that. Like, Greg Friedman was this guy on the team that, like, easily is still one of the smartest people I ever worked with. And the very first time I checked in code, he basically walked over and said, if you ever check anything like that again, I will fire you. And it was like the bar was so high.
What were you learning?
The bar was just so high about what it meant. I mean, we were shipping source code. Adobe was building products that their whole business was based on. We saw it, and whether it was true or not, we saw our job as everything that's going to be built for Apple that's great comes, that's going to get built on this. And if what we do stinks at all or has any bugs, then the whole infrastructure crashes down. And now, granted, that was probably a little dramatic at the time, but that's how we kind of prepped ourselves for what we had to do. And the quality of things I had to do was so high. And then the next year I got to speak at WWDC, and I mean, it was just like, literally, it was a little weird because you got to accomplish your dreams really, really early, probably too early.
So did you gave up on your dream of going into politics?
Yeah, I gave up my dream for going into politics because I got an internship at John Kerry's office. And then a month after I got the internship, they said someone whose parents are rich would like their son to have this internship, so you are not going to have this internship anymore.
Wow.
And I quickly realized that I was never going to survive in that world because it wasn't based on what you could do or how you treated people or your skill set. It was based on, and I was coming out of sports and athletics, and it was always like, if I'm good enough, I will make the team. If I'm good enough, like I was captain, if you're good enough and you treat people right and you lead, then you will be the captain. And the politics world slapped me really quickly and said, yeah, none of that crap matters. Like, how much does your mom make?
So was your sense that there, even at the time, or maybe particularly at the time in Silicon Valley, it was much more of a intrinsic meritocracy?
You know, look, I would love to say that in 1995, I was more like, oh my God, I can have free turkey dinner in the Apple cafeteria every day. Like, this is amazing. I would love to tell you that I had that. I think that that's what was true, though. And I give more credit to RWD and a guy named John Butler there who they had every reason to stick me in a corner and give me a bunch of crap jobs. And he's like, no, you're good. You have a chance to make this work. And a guy named Rob Merle, and they gave me a ton of opportunity. They took me to these meetings. They gave me the hard assignments. They let me at 18, 19 be doing stuff that was way outside. Now, definitely outside my pay grade because they also were getting quite a steal. Right. But it was actually funny, a funny aside story. When I took the job offer at Apple, they came to me and they said, well, we really would like you to stay. You've been here for a couple of years. You're a key part of the team. At that point, the company had grown so rapidly, they actually owned the whole building at that point. Like, they were growing, and, you know, I appreciated that they valued me, and they said, we would like you to stay, and we are prepared to make you an offer for $36,000 a year. And I thought, wait, I just got like three times this at the company of my dreams. So thank you for making this really easy, you know. So it was really funny that how that kind of worked out. I don't think I ever had that.
Do you remember when you were at Apple, did any of the people you were working with, have they gone on to do other things that you're familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, it was the second project I was at. So I was at MacApp, and then I went over to the OpenDoc team. And OpenDoc was this like really interesting technology project that I would argue is like the basis for a lot of things that have happened since then, but it was like the definition of being too early.
And that seems to be a recurrent theme for you.
It is. It definitely is. We'll talk about that for sure. But so I, you know, you said this guy named Vincent Lowe, and there's a bunch of people on the team. There's so many smart people, but Vincent in particular was like one of the first 10 people at Ariba, and then went on to just do incredible things. That team of people was so smart. I was very lucky to be part of it, and I learned so much, you know, being part of it. But it was deep tech; it was pure tech. Wow. And
with that background,
yeah,
it must have been a little bit startling to find that your whole group and all of your talented people were going to be dismissed. It sounds like from Apple. How did you react, and how did you wind up in your next role?
So it was funny. So I also really wanted to work for Steve Jobs. I mean, I had, you know, long before he'd become an international icon, if you will. Those were the books I read as a kid. I remember reading the biography about starting Next and those things. And like, I really wanted to work for him. And it was actually when he came back, that's when the layoff happened. They laid off 5,000 people, and I was part of that. So it was a bit like saying, like, you grow up all your life and you want to be a priest, and then you go to Rome and you're working in the Vatican, and the Pope walks in and goes, yeah, by the way, your branch of the religion, we're not doing that anymore. And so, you know, there was certainly somebody on a pedestal. And I've never had, like, it was never angry. I think I was more angry at myself. Like, I should have been good enough that they wanted to keep me.
Wow.
And I think that was the process I went through. And then, so I think that was really the flow. It was more like, man, this is really disappointing. Like, honestly, it was the first time in my life I felt like I had failed. Like, I had always made the soccer team. I'd always been captain. We'd have been state champions. Like, that stuff had always worked out. I was at Apple. It was the first time that I had not only been let down, but it was extreme. It was like the guy that you were like, yeah, that's the guy. I'm going to figure out how to sneak into his office, you know, which probably good I didn't do that too. Right. But yeah. For him, of all people, to be like, no, what you're working on. And the next year at WWDC, so I spoke at WWDC. The next year, there's this famous YouTube clip I've put on my blog, and I kind of watch every once in a while to humiliate myself. Somebody in the audience asked him about OpenDoc, and he said, oh, I put a bullet in the head of OpenDoc. That was a complete waste of time and the wrong thing for us to be working on.
So did this reinforce that message for you that meritocracy is fake?
No, I don't think so. I think that looking back, he was right. Mm-hmm. It was the wrong thing for Apple to be working on. Apple was never going to be a deep technology company in with his leadership. I mean, maybe with different leadership, if other people had come in and was going to be more of a deep tech company, but a deep tech company wouldn't be the most valuable brand in the world.
Then how did you wind up going from that into getting into the healthcare space in general and into Health Hero in particular?
So a guy named Mitch Allen, who was the director of operating systems. He was one of the people that got laid off, but was, at the time he got laid off, kind of one of the most important people within Apple. He made an introduction between me and Steve Brown, who was a CEO at Health Hero. And, you know, I think, you know, I had a good reputation in general. I really wanted to do something that was a little bit more customer facing and problem solving. The problem with MacApp or OpenDoc is I was building tools, but it's like, I didn't really want to build pickaxes for somebody else to go mine the gold and solve the problems. I wanted to actually solve problems.
So what was the problem that Health Hero was going after, and how were you going about it?
So so much of this is tainted in retrospect. So, you know, at the time, I was too dumb and too stupid and too ignorant about healthcare. I was just like, oh, this seems interesting technology and seems clever. Looking back on it, though, we were really at the forefront of remote patient monitoring and disease management. We built a hardware platform that went into the home, connected to all the medical devices from the standard ones like weight scale and glucose meters to really obscure things like PTINR. We connected in Bluetooth and in IR. wired wireless devices. Went through the whole FDA approval. We were the one of the first to get FDA approval for that kind of thing. I laugh a little now when people talk about how hard it is to get through the FDA. I'm like, try going through the FDA when they have never, ever heard of the idea that you're trying to do. We got stuck in blood chemistry for the review.
So this was really connected health before there was even the earliest. This is one of the earliest concepts of connected health.
I will tell you now that if I was smart enough in, so we were Business Week's best product of 2000. If I was smart enough in back then to say cloud, big data, and connected health.
Bingo.
We probably would have been a $1 billion exit. But I think that, you know, you look back on it now and it's like we had all that data was in the cloud. All of that information was available via web browser. Nurses were connected all over the United States. Doctors were connected all over the United States. We had 132 different disease states that we covered. We had 50 or 60 different glucometers alone. I mean, it was just way out there.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing to be ahead of your time?
So I think this is a very, very personal thing. So I can't separate my personality from this answer. So I would simply say I would rather be way early and help shape the direction that somebody's going to go in than be late and just have figured out how to do a different coat of paint on a problem. So for me, it is so much more interesting to say, oh my God, no one's ever brought this to the FDA, or we've never tried this before, or no one's actually figured out how to get a glucometer delivered to someone's house, like, you know, or send that data into an EMR. I mean, we had to integrate with Vista, with the VA. I mean, you want to talk about, they want to be open, it's just the whole thing's written in months. There's like two guys left in the world that know how that works, right? I mean, and so, you know, the problems we had to solve and the team that we had at Health Hero was so amazing, and the people there, that I think that I would much rather be early, but that also makes me a really dangerous bet because I'd rather push the envelope on how things should be than just say, okay, here's one that's 25% faster and you're going to get a 0.5% return on that.
I imagine that it must have been a really intense experience being both early and being really invested on, you know, on the entrepreneur side versus working as one person in a larger company. What was the impact on you?
I guess there's a couple things. One, when we had, and this is actually true, I make this joke all the time, but it's actually true. When we started Health Hero, I had long hair. Now I struggle to grow any. So I think that there is definitely a physical and mental toll on you. And honestly, you know, my daughter was born during that time. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about work-life balance and stuff. And it's a hard thing to find. And I was at a point in my life where I don't think I did particularly well as a new father those first several years because it was the Health Hero was not all roses. I mean, we were very good at running out of money. We were very good at, you know, just having other issues like that. And it was a hard thing because you're managing a hardware business and a software business. Wow. So it was a challenge.
It's interesting that you don't often hear the men talk about the work-life balance thing. Usually that's a question that's same for women.
Sure.
So I hear a man recognize it and talk about it is sort of interesting. Do you feel like you're doing a better job now?
I hope so. I mean, Mackenzie's old enough now that you can ask her herself, and she will give you a long answer that will probably start with, I made her clean her room or made her do something else, and that's why I'm horrible. But I think that it puts a big strain on any family, I think, when you're going through that kind of ups and downs of money and growing a company and those things. It was a challenge.
So back to the concept of being early, you were part of the formation of Rock Health, or part of the very early team at Rock Health, you know, finding your way.
Yeah,
one
of my very first, I think maybe the very first time I met you was, you were sort of a veteran at Rock Health. This was an incredibly exciting incubator, really, for new companies, for new digital health companies, and all these young sort of wannabe technologists would join, and they would all flock to Jeff, to you, to ask about what is it like in the big show. It was like a veteran ball player where everyone would come to and say, well, what was it like in the big show and how do you get there and what are the real issues? Because they had so much excitement but no grounding in what was actually involved. And I thought they would come to you for your experience and perspective.
So I think that was a very nice way of calling me old. So thanks for that. First of all, so Rock Health, about halfway through the first quarter of the first class, so the class that kind of famously has Omada Health in it and Kinsights and Pipette and a bunch of other just really amazing people, like Ryan, who's now, you know, U.S. Chief U.S. deputy CTO of the U.S. or some crazy thing like that, was in the healthcare.gov. I mean, just an incredible set of people. What Hallie and Leslie and Claire and Nate built is just something, and I'm just very happy to have spent as much time with it as I did.
I think a pivotal part of it, though. I mean, I vividly remember that from the time there.
I think that that's very kind. I think there was a lot of people that contributed to that and that deserve a tremendous amount of credit. The time that I've spent there, and unfortunately, having started better, I have to spend a lot less. But the team is now much bigger. It's a new location. It's not the kind of rat-infested Chinatown place we used to be in. But I loved that. And honestly, that what those people gave back to me was as important as anything that I gave to them. I appreciate what you said, but they also had to give back to me the, like, yeah, I want to do this again. You know, that was kind of my period where I wasn't working. We had sold Health Hero. You know, I did pretty well and took a bunch of time off. And that was like, no, I miss this. I love this. I want to do this. So they gave back to me as much as anything that I gave to them.
So my perception of Rock Health in the early days in particular, more in the early days, was it was many, many tech people coming to healthcare for the first time.
Sure.
And you were like that one time too.
I was that,
one tech guy that came to healthcare for the first time. How does that work? I mean, can you get tech guys to come in and solve the problems, or what do you think about that? There's a raging debate, of course, always going on about whether the tech guys should come and fix the mistakes of the healthcare guys, or whether the healthcare guys are actually capable of fixing their own problems.
So I think three things. The first thing I think about that is, honestly, can I swear on this podcast?
Please. Sure, swear away.
Please.
No one who matters gives a shit about this argument, right? This is a stupid, made-up argument for all of us in the space. And let's be honest, there's like 1,000 of us who give a shit about digital health, right? To argue with each other on Twitter, right? Patients, consumers, they don't give a crap where the solution came from. Right? No one cares whether this is a Sutter solution or a PAMP solution or a Kaiser solution or a Johns Hopkins solution. No one gives a shit. It is a totally made up bullshit argument. And so now I think like Eric Topol's most recent book, The Patient Will See You Now, about the patient's role, that's what's important. And maybe when he talks about doctors and the way we need to change things, there are elements of the conversation that's important. But the basic conversation, which is like, can tech guys do this or can healthcare guys do this? Okay. It makes totally sense that on the doctor side or the healthcare side or the payer side, whatever part of healthcare you want to start with, you had 100 years to do this right and you haven't, so F you, we're going to do it differently. And on the tech side, it's easy to say, you guys don't know what the hell you're talking about. This is a nuanced space that's really confusing. And so what's the takeaway? We should probably be trying to do it together. And rather than like focus on can you do it or can you do it, which I think is just such a bullshit argument. It's just tired and stupid that that we should be focused on like actually making solutions that people give a damn about. My grandparents, my mom, me, I don't give a crap. Like, I don't give a crap who makes the solution. I just want the solution.
So now you're running a company called Better.
That's
true. Why don't you say what that does?
So Better is a personal health assistant service. What that means is we're trying to use technology to scale great people. My learnings in healthcare at the end of the day is that I do think that unlike a lot of industries, healthcare requires personal relationships. At the end of the day, we don't want to hear from a machine, you have cancer. We don't want to hear from a machine all of the nuances of healthcare. There's a relationship to be built there. And I would argue that's true in education and that's true in finance. But to scale them, to scale those things requires great technology. So this is an example. So Mayo Clinic is an investor and a partner. They're clearly the healthcare side. You can't really get much less tech than Rochester, Minnesota, with no offense to Rochester. And then on the other side, Social Capital Partnership was part of the founding investment team, which is like the growth hacking team from Facebook. You can't really get less healthcare than that.
A lot of fleece vests over there, as I recall.
So there's a few
and choice vests. Words about physicians and healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what's interesting is trying to build. That's why I think is what's so exciting about the team that we pulled together is like, that's a team of people where, you know, traditionalists at Mayo might be like, meh, Silicon Valley. And futurists at Social Capital might be like, meh, Mayo. But Mayo is actually an LP in Social Capital. And we have found the people both within Social Capital that see the value of the healthcare system and people within Mayo who see the value of technology, because the solution to serve hundreds of millions of people lives at the intersection. If somebody wants to do something with 100 people, fine. Be a concierge doctor, move to Scottsdale, do whatever the hell you want. But I'm not interested in that. Okay.
So are you ahead of your time again? I mean, your product is sold to consumers, right? I mean, consumers pay for this, not enterprises.
This is true.
And I, for one, have been on record many times saying consumers won't pay for anything.
I believe the first time I told you about the company, you said, are you crazy?
It's so, possible. Yeah. I probably wouldn't say that to you anyway, but nevertheless.
Also true. And I took out the swear word, but
I'm wondering how you feel about that. I mean, are you, obviously you're doing it because you believe in it, but do you worry? Are you too early again for the consumer purchasing side of this equation?
So we have done a few employer deals. We have done a few affinity networks. And I think the learning from Health Hero is I want to be ready when the market is ready. And the reason we won, the reason Health Hero won, we competed with Panasonic, we competed with Intel, we competed with huge companies that should have kicked the crap out of us in hardware. But we took a consumer-driven approach. We said, we're going to build a product people want to touch every day and use every day. We employed IDEO. We did a lot of things to make that work. Same thing with Better. We're going to focus on getting, honestly, the crap kicked out of us. Because I think the reason EMR systems mostly suck, the reason most health IT sucks, is because there's a single decision maker. It's the CIO of the hospital or the plan administrator. And you don't have to build a great product. You have to solve their problem, which is usually, you know, can you print me out a nice report that goes into Excel? So you get really crappy software and really crappy experiences. We've spent the last year getting the crap kicked out of us by consumers who every month have to decide, do I want to spend $20 a month on this thing? And I get email every day where like, well, if you could just do this or just do that, or here's what I saw, that I'm like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. I never would get that feedback if I was selling into the enterprise exclusively. But we got to pay the bills, so of course we do some of those things. But I think when you look at where ACOs are going, when you look at accountable care organizations, when you look at Obamacare, when you look at the whole thing, people have more money and more responsibility, and that market's only growing.
Could you walk us through an example of someone who's been made better by your...
That's great. I should write that down. Just
so we can understand what the offering actually is.
Personal health assistant service, what that means is that you're really given a right-hand person, an example might be like a financial advisor, right?
But an example of someone who's really...
Yeah, so a person who's using it, there's a number of examples on our website that are, whether it's pregnancy or chronic disease or just administrative issues, people usually come to us and have a problem with, they just lost their health insurance, they don't understand this bill, they've been overcharged. Usually they come to us with administrative issues, and then they start leading into deeper clinical stuff. And so it doesn't have to be a pure clinical reason that they come to us. A lot of times it could just be, I'm fed up. I don't understand the healthcare system. My family's in the middle of this Sutter fight with PAMF, like it's going on locally here. What do I do? I don't understand this stuff. I don't even understand the word deductible. And they've stopped getting healthcare. They've stopped getting preventive medicine. They've stopped getting flu shots. They've stopped doing these things. And there's this study today that just came out in MedCity News shows that like people stop going to the doctors because they don't understand how their insurance works. This is so stupid. And so our goal is to start by helping people feel comfortable with the healthcare system, provide them that assistance to move through it, and that always leads to much more clinical things. So we've got a cystic fibrosis program, we've got a number of deeply clinical programs, but the consumer side just starts with, I'm completely lost within healthcare, help me. I'm lucky, I get about 5 emails a week, probably from people who tell me their story, and one that just comes to mind that I got this week is it's a teacher in Georgia. So you know, when Lisa talks about, you know, consumer and the challenge of somebody spending their hard-earned money, I mean, we're not taking people's HSA or insurance dollars or co-payments. We're competing with their Starbucks money right now. And so this gentleman, he's a teacher in Georgia, and he pays $20 a month. And he sent me this long email about how, as a teacher, he has the access to something in the state it should be like what Better does, as a phone line and people, and there's no app or anything like that. But, you know, and this is Georgia, and it's for a teacher. He's obviously not making a lot of money. And he said, you know, they never write back. They're never there. They're never responsive. And he's like, Jackie, who happens to be his PHA, he's like, I really believe Jackie cares about me. And so he started off with appointments. He turns out obviously I'm not going to tell you about what his medical conditions are, but he has some really serious stuff going on. And, you know, for him, knowing there's somebody that cares about him, that is not only taking care of his appointments and his medications and insurance, but fighting on his behalf, but also helping him with all of the medical and clinical side of things through the Mayo Clinic and other systems. Like, he's paying $20 a month to have a companion to help him navigate both administrative and the clinical side when he could get it for free, just the quality is not there. And I think that's a theme in healthcare, is there's a lot of stuff that people have in healthcare, but the quality is just not there because we're not putting those members first.
That's really interesting. I mean, this whole consumer engagement thing has obviously become a big topic of conversation. Very few people have figured out how to crack this nut.
Yes.
And there's a lot of businesses evolving, trying to, right? So what's the trick? You know, what's the trick that you have to figure out to succeed in engaging the consumer?
So I think the biggest trick is that healthcare doesn't exist. Healthcare is not a single thing. And so what happens is that we tend to silo with the industry. Okay, I'm here for heart failure, or I'm here within this very specific area within a particular disease state. But as a consumer, healthcare is what I see. I don't understand the difference between an MRI and a CAT scan. I don't understand the difference between an X-ray and some other test. I don't understand a generic or this drug. All of this specificity that the 1,000 of us in digital health understand, or the 100,000 if you go to all doctors, consumers don't get any of that crap. They don't understand how my doctor and Blue Cross Blue Shield and all those other things are linked together. And so I think when we want to engage consumers, you have to start by thinking about them as consumers, and you have to start with their problems. And that's as simple as, what are my benefits? Can I actually get an appointment? Can I actually see this kind of person? Can I actually do that kind of thing? Help me understand how this works. And so, but I think it's like any problem. If we were doing finance or energy or anything else, you have to start with, what's the consumer problem? The consumer's problem isn't that I don't have solar panels on my roof. It's, I want cheaper energy.
So you're really focusing on the problem to be solved.
Absolutely. And it's coming from the consumer side. I mean, that's just the most important thing.
So what do you say to yourself, and what would you suggest other entrepreneurs like you who are trying to do something new and different say to themselves? What is the mantra you have to keep going in the face of challenge here?
I mean, you have to love it. I mean, I feel so passionately about what Better does, and I believe that's the way the world should be. I believe the way that the world should be when we did Health Hero was, I looked at veterans like my grandfather, and the VA was our biggest customer in the US, and I thought, he deserves this. Like, this is how it should be. And so when you're in the muck and trying to figure out how to pay the bills or how to do this or that, if you don't believe this is the way the world should be, it's really hard to engage. But for us, like with Better, that's how I believe the world should be. And so it makes sometimes the day a little easier.
Jeff, this was great. It was really great to talk to you today.
It's my pleasure.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming by.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Take care.